The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. It's been a rough couple of months for spaceflight. On October 28th, an unmanned rocket loaded with 5,000 pounds of supplies for the International Space Station exploded just after launch. And 3 days later, one of Virgin Galactic's suborbital planes broke up in flight, crashed in the Mojave Desert, and killed one pilot, severely injured another. These traumatic mechanical failures offer a look into why space tourism may be further away than we think. But even if they can be overcome, what about the psychological effects of reaching outer space? Sydney Brownstone is a staff writer at Fast Company's Coexist, where she wrote about the often ignored mental side of space travel. And Sydney, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Taylor. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, Sydney, it's worth pointing out that you're not really writing about the mental pressures on people who would, say, travel to Mars and maybe be on a spaceship for years at a time. You're looking at the side effects experienced by pilots who are flying suborbitally. That's at very high altitude. So tell us a little bit about the phenomenon that you describe, this break-off phenomenon.
Right. Well, I think it'll be helpful to contextualize the break-off phenomenon in another type of syndrome I stumbled across called the overview effect. This is a syndrome or an experience that, the CEO of Virgin Galactic, George Whitesides, is invested in. There's something called the Overview Institute. Basically, it's this idea that when you pay for space travel, anyone can go up and have this really beautiful epiphany about the fragility of the Earth and the unity of humankind. And it's supposed to be incredibly emotional and intense.
Positive way.
In a very positive way. This is one of the selling points. Some space tourism companies actually use it in their marketing materials. So I knew about this overview effect, and when I started interrogating it a little bit and going through the medical literature, I came across another kind of parallel syndrome called the break-off phenomenon. And this is something that was first reported in 1957 in a paper that interviewed 137 fighter pilots. And this is a term they came up with themselves, the break-off phenomenon. It was this feeling of when they would get up to high altitudes, the feeling dissociated or separated from the Earth. And dissociation is not a term to be taken lightly. It's a very, very, it can be a very scary feeling.
This is sort of what the out-of-body experience.
Right. And the weird thing about the break-off phenomenon, too, is that it wasn't always positive and it wasn't always negative. So two-thirds of the pilots who did describe break-off described it as something calm and peaceful. A few felt closer to God. And then there were about a third of the pilots said they freaked out, basically.
Yeah. Well, how does the break-off effect manifest physically? I mean, we're talking psychologically about people, you know, feeling very calm or feeling closer to God. But what is happening to their bodies?
It's hard to say. A lot of people report a variety of effects. In the medical literature, I found one case of a squadron commander who was hyperventilating and basically displaying the symptoms of a panic attack or several panic attacks. He would get this tightness in his chest. He would lash out at his coworkers. And those kind of all seemed like symptoms he developed after experiencing the break-off phenomenon. But I think that the main symptom is this feeling of dissociation. You feel separated from the Earth, which if you think about it, can be a really positive thing. Oh, I feel free. I feel surreal. And then it can also feel extremely unsettling.
And what happens when this occurs? I mean, they're experiencing something, but how does that affect their ability to fly?
You know, a bunch of there have been a lot of different conclusions. When we first started flying astronauts and cosmonauts, NASA and the Russian Academy of Sciences, they were very concerned about breakoff happening to astronauts and ruining missions. But some researchers concluded that it just wasn't a big deal and it didn't affect someone's ability to fly. On the other hand, we have this other term called spatial disorientation, and breakoff is kind of one symptom in a constellation of weird things that can happen to you when you're flying, and it does cause pilot error, and you know, quite a few people have died because of it.
Now, does it seem like there's a pattern of maybe who experiences breakoff?
Well, the very early researchers made a few connections, and they're a little bit hazy, but if you had a history of mental illness, if you were just having a rough time on Earth, basically, you were more likely to experience the negative effects of breakoff. And one researcher I spoke to who was working on an Air Force base in the 80s and 90s worked with pilots very closely who didn't really want to tell her about breakoff and didn't want to tell her about their feelings at first. But when they opened up, they told her that some of the traumas and stresses they experienced on Earth would become magnified in flight. For example, a pilot who recently lost his son and his wife was flying, and he heard their voices. When he heard their voices, he realized that he was spiraling into a dive. He had made a very dangerous mistake, and he was able to pull himself out of it. But this is something that rattled him.
I'm speaking with Fast Company's Sydney Brownstone about the influence of space travel on mental health, specifically a phenomenon referred to as the breakoff effect. Now, you mentioned in your article that this phenomenon seems to have disappeared from the literature anyway in the 70s. Was it so hard to pin down? Partially, you mentioned that pilots are skeptical to talk to psychiatrists. Is that part of the issue?
It's hard. It's hard to pin down. There's definitely something called the lie to fly culture, which is the idea that if you're a pilot or you're an astronaut, you don't want to say anything to your flight surgeon that's going to ground you and ruin your career. If you say, well, I was flying at 70,000 feet in a U-2 spy plane, and I thought I heard the voice of my dead son, you know, the flight surgeon might think that you're not able to do your job. If you go into space because of G-forces or because of the ergonomics of the ship or, you know, just how our bodies are built, astronauts will puke. This is something that space tourists will almost certainly experience, too. A lot of space tourists will throw up for certain. But astronauts didn't want to show this to their flight surgeons for a very long time, so they tried to hide the fact that they were throwing up in space. So the fact that this disappeared in the 70s could be in part due to lie-to-fly culture. You know, as the space shuttle program was ramping up, NASA didn't want to cast the idea of an astronaut as someone who is vulnerable.
Well, I suppose the difference for space tourism is that you might be paying $250,000 to throw up in space. But astronauts, you know, they do go through these rigorous physical and mental tests to be able to determine whether or not they're fit for space travel. What about civilians who may pay in the future to go on these suborbital flights? Are they going to be tested in the same ways?
It's hard to tell because there's nothing really regulating this type of activity at the moment. But I did get the opportunity to visit a space training center called NASTAR, which has trained the first Virgin Galactic and X-Corps space tourists. And what they offer is a two-day training program to acclimate a person to G-forces. These are the acceleration forces that a person will feel both vertically and horizontally as they're going to space. So no, they are not subject to the same type of rigorous, you know, psychological, physical testing as astronauts were. And it's a completely different culture, too, because now, or presumably in the next couple of years, anyone who can afford space travel can go up. A lot of the selling points for these companies are, you know, you don't need to have a specialized background. We'll take you. We're making that available to you.
Well, does that seem okay to you, given that these are people that aren't going to be behind the controls? So maybe they can experience the breakoff phenomenon, but it won't be devastating because there's no chance that they'll spiral downwards and crash the plane.
Given the reporting that I've done, I do have concerns about this attitude being kind of cavalier and not communicating the fullness of the experience to these space tourists. Because if you're selling the overview effect, you're selling one kind of experience. It's going to be positive. It's going to be an epiphany. You're going to realize all these things about the Earth and your duty to protect it without communicating the fact that you might go up there and your traumas or stresses might be magnified. I think it's important to say that there's a range of experiences a person could have. And, you know, I'm no expert, but maybe a 2-day training course isn't enough to prepare someone mentally for space.
It sounds to me like they're selling the idea that tourists can take a 2-day course to prepare for the experience of taking acid.
That's exactly the conversation I've had with my editors. They're like, so this is like an acid trip, right? And I go, pretty much. And there's actually, you know, I interviewed a researcher who wrote a paper on, you know, that mentioned Breakoff, but it was about hallucinogenic experiences that don't require hallucinogenic drugs. And so much of the literature on this stuff, it uses the same language of like ritualistic hallucinogenic experiences and the ego separating from itself and becoming closer to the divine. It's very, very trippy.
Sydney, once we've got people into space, potentially in the future for very long periods of time, do you think that there are mental side effects like the Breakoff effect that we don't yet understand that might arise as we get further and further into our efforts to explore space?
That's actually a major concern of NASA's at the moment. You know, as we get further and further away from the Earth, let's say interstellar travel, some researchers have discussed this syndrome called Earth out of view. And it's kind of like an exaggerated version of the Breakoff phenomenon. You know, as the world shrinks smaller in your rear view mirror, what will happen to you? You could think of parallels here on Earth. You could think of deep sea diving or extreme isolation for long periods of time. And there are certainly people who have done that and other people who have studied it, but I don't think we'll ever know until we actually do it and find out.
Well, Sydney, thank you so much for taking time to explain this to us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Taylor.
Sydney Brownstone is a staff writer at Fast Company's Coexist, and you can find a link to her article on the Breakoff effect and the mental side of space travel at wordofmouthradio.org. Bill Littlefield has tackled sports from every literary angle, as a commentator, a columnist, an essayist, a novelist, and now as a poet. In his latest book, Take Me Out, Littlefield uses poetic verse to cover all sorts of games, from football to baseball, chess to roller derby. You probably know Bill Littlefield as the host of NPR's Only a Game, heard every Saturday morning right here on NHPR. And Bill will be speaking and signing copies of Take Me Out this Saturday at the Toadstool Bookshops in Milford and Peterborough. And Bill Littlefield, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with your poem about Olympians. They may not be giants. Could you read that one for us?
Sure. It won't take very long.
Well, we picked it for a reason.
That's good. They might not be giants. Olympians need not be giants. They need not be tall. The female gymnasts at the games are sometimes kind of small.
So this is a great one. And one reason I really enjoyed it is that, you know, of course, you've written poems here about mainstream sports like baseball and football, but you've got a lot of off the beaten path sports as well. Was it hard to compose poems about gymnastics or squash or croquet?
No, it was challenging. And it was fun. There was really nothing, no labor involved in this. It was just fun. And that has distinguished it from every other book I've written. The others were hard work. This was fun.
Do you feel like you really know enough about every sport to compose a poem, or did you have to do any research?
Very little research, because doggerel, the kind of poetry that I write, really doesn't lend itself very much to research. No, it was just, you know, kind of goofy stuff. Squash is a vegetable as well as a game, so I had some fun with that, you know, that sort of thing.
As I was looking over the poems, I realized that I could only think of a couple poems, aside from your book, about sports, Casey at the Bat being the only one that I think people might recognize. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is, that we don't see so much poetry about sports?
Well, I think there is actually a fair amount of poetry about sports. Homer wrote about boxing, and he wasn't too bad a poet. So, you know, we can go all the way up to that. And Donald Hall up there in New Hampshire writing about Ted Williams not so very long ago. So it's out there. You have to kind of look for it, but it's out there.
You've got to weed through the romance.
Yeah, yeah, and the cliches that generally constitute sports writing.
Well, you know, speaking of cliches, I think that a lot of us are led to believe that literature and a love of sports are sort of diametrically opposed. But do you think that's the case, or do you think sports are really good fodder for literature?
Oh, I think historically sports have been spectacularly good fodder for literature. I can name numbers of writers and novels and short story writers who have made all sorts of good use of sports. The one I was thinking about earlier today was Mark Harris, who wrote Bang the Drum Slowly and the whole series of wonderful Henry Wiggin novels. You can go all the way back to Damon Runyon and the brilliant stuff that he wrote that passed as sports writing, but really it was literature. And I've had the opportunity over the years to read a great deal of it. W.C. Hinds, Bill Hinds, who a brilliant, brilliant writer, and to the great benefit of sports, he wrote about sports.
And then, of course, there's folks like Charlie Pierce, who we hear on the show every week.
There is Charlie Pierce, who not only writes brilliantly about sports, but talks brilliantly about sports, at least on a weekly basis.
So what makes it good writing? Is it, I mean, I wouldn't think it would necessarily be the sport as subject, but the subject as a vehicle?
Well, sometimes the subject really does lend itself to good writing because there's suspense built into most athletic competitions and character. You see what happens to players who fail and what happens to players who succeed. And, of course, an athletic career is a kind of short version of a life where you're old in baseball terms. For example, by the time you're in your mid-30s, late 30s at the latest, you may have half your life still to lead, but you're an old man in terms of your legs not being quite as good as they used to be and your eye not being as sharp. So you get that kind of compressed version of what it's like to live a life acted out in front of thousands or millions of people.
Yeah, and then there's the underdog stories and I suppose the scandals too, like Armstrong.
Altogether too many of them. But yeah. Yes, you're right. They're all human interest stories and they all take place in the context of games.
Do you find that certain sports make for better narrative arcs than others? I mean, we were talking about this. We couldn't think of a single novel that, you know, featured a tennis player so much as we could think of so many baseball ones.
Well, Martina Navratilova wrote, or at least allegedly wrote, a couple of mystery novels that were set in tennis. But I'm not sure how good they were. I didn't read them. But you're right. Some sports probably lend themselves to great storytelling. Baseball certainly has going for it the incredible amount of history and the statistics and the myths and the way you can go to a ball game and see a young player and say, well, gee, you know, that guy reminds me a little bit of fill in the blank with your favorite shortstop or center fielder. So there is that kind of background that's available to anybody who is inclined to write about it. And drama is built in, as I say, to pretty much all sports where competition is involved.
In fact, you wrote a novel about baseball called Prospect.
Prospect was born in part out of my acquaintance with a guy who'd been a major league scout for many years. And I met him and I was fascinated by him. It was a guy named Lenny Marullo who played shortstop for the Cubs back in the 40s and then made a long career as a major league scout when his playing career was over. And he just had so many stories about guys that he had scouted. And the more I looked, the more stories there were. And I thought, well, this would be a scout would be a great narrator for a novel because anytime I ran out of a gas in terms of moving the plot forward, I'd just have him tell another baseball story and that would take up several pages. And it worked out pretty well.
Do you think, speaking of those off the beaten path sports, that we're likely to see a great American novel about gymnastics anytime soon?
Anything is available, you know. A good writer who's fascinated by something and enthusiastic about it and can bring energy to the task, the subject really is secondary, I think.
Today, we are seeing more and more in-depth coverage of sports. I'm thinking of ESPN's documentary series 30 for 30, websites like Grantland, Do you think we're entering a golden age of sports writing in journalism?
That's an excellent question. We're certainly entering an age where a lot of what used to be called journalism is appearing in places other than newspapers or magazines, that's for sure. And some of it is terrific. All you have to do is look at Houghton Mifflin's annual collection of best American sports writing, and you see that more and more of it is coming from blogs or websites, and it's spectacularly good.
Bill Littlefield is the host of NPR's Only a Game and author of several books, including his latest, Take Me Out. It's a collection of illustrated poetry. And Bill, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Bill will be speaking and signing copies of Take Me Out this Saturday at Toadstool Bookshop in Milford and Peterborough. You'll find details on both events on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And Bill, before we go, is there a specific poem from the collection that you'd like to read? Another one?
Since you mentioned sports that are a little bit out of the mainstream, how about one on polo? Is that all right?
Polo sounds perfect.
Okay, here we go. There is this game called polo. It's a splendid game, of course. You swing a mallet at a ball while riding on a horse. You ride upon the horse, I mean. The ball is on the ground, and when you whack the ball, it makes a very pleasing sound, a kind of thwack, I guess you'd say, much deeper than a click. And doing all this on a horse is quite a clever trick. I'm sure the people playing polo have a lot of fun. The horses? I don't really know. I've never questioned one.
You can get your chance to hear more from Bill Littlefield. There's information at wordofmouthradio.org. Bill, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Clap your hands! Stomp your feet. Stomp your feet.
Stick around for more Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to be quenching your thirst with America's only water sommelier, the curious art of water tasting, after the break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever been faced with the daunting task of choosing a wine from a long list at a fine restaurant, you may have enlisted the help of a wine sommelier. The sommelier is an expert who's charged with creating the wine list, procuring the selections, and guiding patrons on which wines will pair best with their meals. But what happens when you're not sure what kind of water to order? Our next guest can help you with that decision. Martin Risa is America's only water sommelier. He's also the general manager at Ray's and Stark Bar at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, which boasts a 44-page water menu. And Martin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello. Thank you for being on the show.
A 44-page water menu, it seems kind of overwhelming. How are the different waters arranged? Is it like wine, where certain waters are paired with chicken and others are paired with steak?
So my water list starts kind of with the countries. So it's alphabetically in order by countries, because every single country has beautiful springs. And the really funny thing is, and a lot of people still don't believe that actually, and this is my part right now here in America, that water is not just water. Water actually has taste. It all depends on the mineral level where the water is coming from. And every single country and every single grounds have different mineral levels, and therefore you can actually taste the terroir of the water.
So, I mean, I can understand that in the sense that I have had, I have had tap water that I thought tasted funny. But I guess the degree of difference here, maybe in terms of taste of water, is not the same as taste of, say, wines from lowest quality to highest.
No, correct. You're absolutely right. What I'm saying, like, by wine, it's kind of similar, but you should think it's all about like one grape and the water, and the grape calls water. So, for example, it's not about like a Pinot Noir tastes differently than a Cabernet Sauvignon or like a Riesling to a Sauvignon Blanc. By water, it's more like, imagine you have a Riesling from Washington State and a Riesling from Germany and a Riesling from California. And they're all tasting slightly different. And this is the same what we're doing in water. So they're all tasting slightly different, but it's not like that this one water suddenly is red and the other water suddenly yellow.
So let's stick with this wine comparison. When people try wines, you know, there's a variety of rituals, you know, smelling the wine, swirling the glass for oxygen, palate cleansers. Now, do you have a process for when you drink water that's similar?
I'm always checking, first of all, the taste or actually the smell of the glass, because glasses can have a smell as well. It depends when they're not really cleaned. Actually, you're doing the same when you're doing wine tastings. You're always like pushing a little bit air in your glass with your nose and then like inhale this air to see if actually the glass is like completely free of odors. That's extremely important by water, because water should be odorless. And when you have suddenly like a like disturbing odor from a water glass, that really doesn't give you the whole experience in water. The second thing is literally like, I'm drinking like in a water tasting the same what I would do in a wine tasting. I'm actually not chilling down my waters, because I want to have like the whole like experience of a water. And it's all about wine tastings as well. When you're chilling down all your wines extremely down, you will not taste anymore all the aspects of the wine. So when you're chilling down a beverages, and I know Americans love to chill down beverages, but they're sometimes actually losing the ability of taste profiles or the drinks, what they're actually drinking. So stick away from ice cubes and this kind of things, especially by water tasting. And then I'm like swirling it. I'm putting oxygen as well into my mouth to see like the whole flavor access to gain my palate. And I'm drinking water the same like what I would do in a wine tasting, except for one big thing. I don't have to spit it out. That's a beautiful thing about a water tasting. I can get drunk.
Yeah, but you must have to go to the bathroom all the time.
I'm tasting water professional since 2005, and I don't want to know how many times I'm spending on the bathrooms.
So in 2010, you received your certification as a mineral water sommelier from the German Mineral Water Trade Association. Now, was there a lot of training or an exam that went into that?
So it was kind of interesting. I told you, since 2005, I'm doing like water tastings, and I'm rethinking my use of water. Because a customer came up to my restaurant and said, hey, Martin, you'd have 1,500 different positions of wine, but you just have one water brand. And I don't like that water brand. Do you have something else for me? And he kind of opened my eyes, because I realized as a child already that water has taste. And I thought like, hey, here we are in the restaurant business. It's all about options. And when it comes to water, we're just saying sparkling, flat, or tap. And this, I think, should be changed, because water has taste. So I created this water menu. I started to drink water all the time. I wrote a book in 2008, actually, about water. It's 200 pages thick. And then in 2010, the Water Trade Association came up to me and said, Martin, you have so much knowledge. We should give you a certification for that, because we need people like you to tell other people that water is not just water. So in 2010, I received my certification.
So has anybody ever tried to pull a fast one on you and just, you know, tell you that you're tasting a water from the Alps or that's melted from a glacier, when it's really, in fact, just tap water to sort of test your abilities?
Oh, all the time. It's normal for me, actually. That's my daily basis here. They're trying that people. My wife and I went to Vegas for like 3 months ago, and we went over there to a restaurant and they recognized me. And it's kind of scary, actually. I'm here since 3.5 years, and then people recognize me as a water sommelier. I don't know if I'm really feeling comfortable with that. I just want to give options to my guests. That's pretty much it, what I want to do. But still, I came to this restaurant, and they had three glasses of water right in front of me. One was Las Vegas tap and two other spring waters. And I tasted right away the Las Vegas tap water. And they looked at me like, oh my God, you really can do it. He said, yeah, sure, definitely, I can do it. I'm not like trying to pretend to do something. I'm actually a thirsty guy.
Martin, can you be sure that a bottled water comes from the place that it's advertised as coming from? I've heard that the industry, forgive the pun, I've heard that the industry isn't always transparent.
The industry is transparent. You just have to look at the labels. And here in America, the laws are very, very strict about this. And when it says purified water, that means actually it comes from a tap water source or something like this. So bottled water is not just bottled water. And we're thinking, oh, we have tap water and we have just bottled water. Bottled water has huge differences. So we're starting with purified water. That means it's actually nothing else than tap water. Then we have spring water, comes from the spring where it's labeled on. And we have mineral water, what has to have a TDS level. And TDS stands for total dissolved solids. So that means it has a lot of minerals in it, at least by 500 TDS or more. So these are the three aspects of bottled water, what you can buy here in America.
So how do you win over the naysayers then, who say that water has no taste, that say that there's no difference between them, and that, you know, you shouldn't be paying more or less for a certain type of water because of its mineral content? Do you have a pitch for them, or do you just let it lie?
I have a pitch definitely for them, and a 100% success rate on that pitch. They just have to come to my restaurant. I will get them a small water flight with three different waters, and everybody's realizing, oh my God, water actually has a taste. And then it's all about preference. when people are saying LA tap is fine for me, I would never argument with that. Sure, that's their taste. Great, wonderful. I'm providing water for people. So for me, actually, it doesn't matter what you want to drink. It's for me about which water would be the best for your palate, for your health. And this is the reason where I'm coming in then and will tell you, hey, you should maybe try this water. You should try this water. This water has that impact on that wine. And then it's getting interesting and fascinating. And I have to say as well, like a lot of kids love the water menu. They come into my restaurant. They think, first of all, it's so funny because every single water has like its own page with a bottle shape and everything. So they love to look in it. And kids have the ability because their palate is so unique still. And it's not like ruined kind of by all the spices what we're eating over our whole life, that they can really taste water very uniquely in a very unique way. And they love to do water tastings. They feel like grown up. They suddenly can do tastings. They're getting wine glasses from me and they can zip in the different waters. They love the whole experience.
Well, Martin, I'll raise a toast to that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Always, always. Thank you.
Martin Risa is the General Manager and Water Sommelier at Rays and Stark Bar at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. We've got links to find out more at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, Martin was so convincing, we decided to engineer our own little water taste test. So producer Logan Shannon hit the grocery store, cleaned a few of her nicest tumblers, so no weird glass smell. And she and senior producer Maureen McMurray joined me in the studio to sample some high-quality H2O.
Okay, so we're going to start with Voss.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yep.
So this is from Norway.
Well, I rinsed my mouth out with tap to get the morning coffee out of my mouth, and this is much smoother.
So Martin's notes for Voss was that it would be slightly bitter and metallic.
Oh, I'm definitely not getting that.
Okay. So the next one we're going to try is Fiji water, which is a pretty iconic bottle.
And it's more expensive whenever I go into like a gas station or something. If I'm feeling fancy, I'll get the Fiji.
Yeah, it's definitely high-end water.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this tastes more like tap to me. Like there's more of a minerally flavor.
Or something like musty.
a musty mineral flavor.
His tasting notes on this were fruity and smooth.
No. Fruity? That is a joke. It's water.
All right.
I could taste what he tastes.
Oh, no.
This is so sad.
I know. Well, now we will move on to the sparkling mineral waters. So this is San Pellegrino, which I would say most restaurants serve if you ask for sparkling water.
This, I mean, obviously it has a taste.
Yeah.
I think the hard thing for me is that most of the water that I drink to counteract all the coffee. And so this, of all the waters we've tasted, is the only one thus far that I can actually enjoy a little bit because it has some taste and texture, and it's not just I'm trying to hydrate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has a little personality to it.
Yeah, it's got a little zing. We've got one more
left. We've got one more, and this is also from Italy. This is Blue Italy, which you can buy at Trader Joe's.
This one already sounds more aggressive.
Oh, that is totally and utterly different.
Wow, yeah.
That one absolutely is.
Mm.
Even the aftertaste.
Well, the fizz fizzed harder and faster on my tongue. I'm not sure which one. I think I like the San Pellegrino better.
I do too.
And I would choose Hawaiian for my still. I really liked that water.
I'm going for the still simply based on the bottle design with Voss.
Oh, yeah.
I think for the still water, I'm going with tap.
Because it's free.
Because it's free. All right. Well done. Thank you. Cheers.
If you'd like to try your own water taste test, water sommelier Martin Risa suggested a few to try. We've got more info plus a link to his 44-page water menu at wordofmouthradio.org. Here in the U.S., getting water is as easy as turning on a faucet. In Nepal, however, it can be very serious business. Reporter Lauren Spiro discovered this for herself when she spent 9 months living with a family in a small farming village in central Nepal. And she brings us this story.
The water tap closest to our house is a small concrete pen with a spout protruding from a rock. There's usually a scattering of people, mostly women and girls chattering nonchalantly around a cluster of tin jugs. But don't be deceived. This is a battleground. Now, there are rules. Rule number one, You must adhere at all times to a strict system of maneuvering. It works like this. As I arrive, I set down my tin jugs close to the spout, but not too close. Confident, but not cocky. I am now in line. Rule number two. There is no line. It's a virtual line where everyone takes note of who has arrived when. Still, your place must be defended as your turn approaches by moving closer to the spout. Vigilantly, but not presumptuously. Rule number three. The virtual line is enforced through joint regulation. We watch for cheaters who move their jugs in too close, too quickly. Cheaters are handled with varying degrees of severity, depending on their age, status, and ferocity. I lack all three of these advantages, so for me, outright cheating is not an option. However, that brings us to rule number four. Tactical alliances may be arranged. This is my specialty. Let's say an aggressor places their water jug under the spout when it's my turn. I exchange glances with, say, Lakshmi, the girl who does housework for the school headmaster. Lakshmi climbs up behind the water spout, thereby monopolizing access, and then shouts, "Laura, Dee Dee, sister!" as if my name is a football play. I hand her my water jug, and she hooks it right under the spout until the offender has removed their vessel from underneath it. And then, to prove a point, when my jug is full, I hand Lakshmi hers, so that there's never an opening for challenge. Then we declare victory and walk home together while the old ladies yell after us. Rule five is the trickiest. The water tap involves all kinds of unspoken social conventions that are completely invisible to the uninitiated. For example, you may find, as I did on a particularly busy day, that just as you arrive, a woman will begin to yell at you in a furious tumble of incomprehensible words. And you may think, quite correctly, I am in full accordance with the system of maneuvering, as you make your way, at the proper speed, towards the water spout. But then, the woman will take a palmful of water and toss it into your face for no reason whatsoever. Back at the house, Amma is waiting for me, and I cry indignantly that her only American daughter has been mistreated at the water tap. Amma sighs and then explains, I must have stood too close to low caste water jugs, and in the Hindu caste system, water is a conductor of impurity. The tainted object, in this case, me, can be cleansed with a sprinkling of water that has touched gold, such as an earring. Our neighbor had been looking out for my high-caste Brahmin family by purifying the foolish foreign water girl. So much for the system. Some rules can only be learned on the job.
That piece came to us from the World Vision Report. And we stay on the international stage for a bit longer. When Word of Mouth returns, we'll speak with National Geographic's chief content officer to find out what goes into selecting the cover of the magazine. That conversation when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. An Afghan girl with startling green eyes, the ghostly wreckage of the Titanic, Jane Goodall observing a family of chimpanzees. There's just something about the images on the cover of National Geographic magazine that sears into the collective memory. Chris Johns has a unique perspective on National Geographic's iconic covers. Throughout a decade-long stint as editor-in-chief and currently as the magazine's chief content officer, he's played a key role in selecting the images that make it to the front page. But he's also been on the other side of the table as well, having first come to National Geographic as a photographer. He joins me now to demystify the process of selecting a cover image and to talk about a stunning new book from National Geographic, The Covers, Iconic Photographs, Unforgettable Stories. And Chris Johns, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Wonderful to be with you, Taylor.
So as a photographer, your images landed on the cover of National Geographic 8 times. Any that you're particularly proud of?
I would say that the image I'm probably the most proud of was a cover I did, actually one of my first stories, and it was one of my first international stories. And of all things, it was a story on soybeans. And, of course, what's wonderful about a journey for National Geographic magazine are these discoveries you make. And in one particular case, we made a discovery that geishas in training to learn how to use their chopsticks beautifully, they practice with a very silky tofu in Japan. And it became actually a pretty sensuous cover, which was one of my first covers.
Can you describe it for me? And maybe tell me what about it that makes it a cover shot?
It's a very striking image visually. It's extremely tight upon the geisha's face with white makeup and this beautiful red lipstick. So it's a picture that's easy to recognize. It's got a degree of provocativeness. It has beauty in it, and it has surprise in it that you wouldn't necessarily associate this rather drab-looking plant that produces soybeans with,
right,
a food and a culture that beautiful.
What does the cover selection process look like? I mean, how long does it take? Who's involved? How many people?
Well, I would submit that the cover process starts about 2 years before a year to 2 years before the cover's published.
Wow.
Because we start to identify stories that we believe will make powerful covers. And then, it finally comes down to the editor-in-chief of the magazine, Susan Goldberg, the creative director, Bill Maher, our publisher, and we sit and have a discussion about what cover we think is the most successful. In many cases, we'll say we don't quite have it yet. We'll go back to the drawing board. But ultimately, at the end of the day, while we do it as a group, the decision ultimately rests with the editor-in-chief, Susan Goldberg.
Well, it's amazing to think that you do this 2 years sometimes in advance of the cover. Is the content also being created with that much forethought?
Absolutely. But that's also to say that there may be a story that we do a very quick turnaround on as well.
Do you find that certain subjects tend to work better for the cover than others?
Oh, we certainly do. Yes, archaeology, ancient civilizations do. For example, a Mayan cover we had in 2007 was an incredibly popular cover. A recent story we did on Stonehenge was an incredibly popular cover. But the other thing we've learned, too, is people love science, and they especially love a science they connect with. An example of that would be in March 2008, we had a magnificent border collie that looks just like my border collie, Mickey, and it's called Inside Animal Minds.
A couple other rules that I read in the book. Ancient civilization space does very well.
Yes.
Animals don't do as well as you might think. Pets do, so that speaks to
the
cover that you're talking about. And another one, portraits aren't very good. Why is that?
Well, I don't think people – we're called National Geographic, and people are interested in us because of our emphasis on geography and places. Now, earlier we were talking about rules. I'll tell you two rules on the portrait end and the animal end beyond pets that have been broken. And one, of course, is that famous iconic cover of the Afghan girl.
Of course, with the incredible eyes.
Right. In June of 1985, we found her 17 years later and put her on the cover as a mature woman, a mother, in April of 2002. On the natural history or wildlife realm, a very popular cover we did in 2008 was a penetrating photograph, a portrait of a mountain gorilla looking you right in the eyes, and the headline for that one is "Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas?" This was after a catastrophic event that occurred in Virunga National Park in Africa,
mm-hmm.
Where some crime syndicates had come in and literally murdered gorillas, and that cover sold very well for us because there's an emotional connection with that gorilla that you don't really quite find in too many other animals. Like I say, there are exceptions to every rule. If the photograph and the cover line support each other, a portrait or a wild animal can work on the cover.
National Geographic first appeared on newsstands in 1998. Before that, you had to have a subscription. Now, did that change the cover selection process moving forward?
What I think it did for us, Taylor, was it made us really value clarity, to be very direct and clear as to what that cover story is and why you need to pick it up and read it.
Another significant date in National Geographic history, quite a bit earlier, though, 1959, when the very first color photograph appeared on the cover. So I'm guessing that that must have inspired a big reaction.
It did. And that photograph, believe it or not, was a fighter jet. That cover was fine.
Fine isn't exactly a glowing review.
Well, you know, times change. The fact is that cover now would never work for us. It's simply not good enough. I'm just being very honest with you.
How so?
What you would want now is a cover that's probably a little more energetic, that's a little more provocative. And, you know, in 1955, that cover was fine. That was good. But, you know, we didn't have the crowded space we do now in the media environment. You know, times are different.
Well, the world of photography has changed a lot since the 50s, of course, and photographers and editors now have Photoshop at their disposal. Has that posed any challenges in probably what I would think the past 10 years or so?
What it's done for us is really given us an opportunity to talk about the virtues of authenticity, that the photographs on our magazine are not altered. They're real. They're with real people, real events taken by people who deeply care about the subject they're photographing and have gone to great lengths to make pictures in many cases that have never been made before. And the technology, of course, is fantastic. I'll give you an example. In October 2009, we had a cover story on the redwoods, the world's tallest trees. Mm-hmm. Michael Nichols had worked in the Humboldt County area in Northern California for almost a year to photograph the world's tallest trees. And as a young boy who was raised in southwestern Oregon, very close to the redwoods, I recall going into Redwood National Park and Jedediah Smith National Park and looking at these trees and wondering what on earth the top looked like. You know, and I can't even see the whole tree. I could just see the very bottom in this lush, beautiful forest. And Nick, of course, had that same feeling when he was working in Humboldt County. So he worked very closely with our technical people to figure out a way to photograph that tree using cameras, three cameras, on a platform suspended on a line between the tree they're photographing and another redwood tree, to photograph it from top to bottom, and then to stitch nearly 100 pictures together to give you a complete, accurate composite of a redwood tree from top to bottom. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that have been a joy for us to embrace. And, of course, that does mean digital photography is key to doing that. Computers are key to doing that, but it's a real photograph. It's not something that you know, we doctored to try to make it more entertaining or whatever the case may be.
Well, I suppose we can't say goodbye until you answer one last question, and that, of course, has to be, what is your all-time favorite cover from the magazine's history?
Oh, gosh, you know, I
thought this might stump you.
You know what I would say to that, Taylor, is that almost varies from day to day, if not week to week. Today, what I'd say is that July 2008 photograph and cover lines of Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas is my favorite.
Well, Chris John, if you change your mind tomorrow, just email us and we'll let everybody know. And thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Chris Johns is Chief Content Officer of National Geographic, which is out with a beautiful new book, The Covers, Iconic Photographs, Unforgettable Stories. If you'd like to see some of the stunning images we talked about today, we've got a slideshow on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier this week, we talked to Silvio Pietrolongo. He's vice president of charts and data development at Billboard, about some changes that are being made to the Billboard 200. That's their week-by-week list of the country's top-selling albums.
You know, we're keeping the pure sales part intact, but we're also adding streaming activity of tracks from albums and also downloaded tracks as well.
Well, those changes went into effect on Wednesday, and while there weren't any huge shifts in the rankings, we were surprised to see that 1989 returned to number one, proving that album sales still trump streaming when it comes to Taylor Swift. The big winner in Billboard's new chart metric, as Silvio Pietrolongo predicted, is Ariana Grande. Her album My Everything jumped from 39th place on the Billboard 200 to number 7. Also creeping up the list from 13th place to 9th is the soundtrack to Frozen, which made the top 10 for the first time since September, proving that parents everywhere should expect to hear Let It Go at least another couple thousand times before their kids find a new obsession.
Let it go, let it go, can't hold it back anymore.
Well, that about does it for today's show. Thanks for spending some time with us. Earlier in the program, we chatted with Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game about the art of sports writing, and he provided us a list of his favorite sports books. You can check it out at wordofmouthradio.org. You might be able to find a really good Christmas present if you've got a big sports fan in the family. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
It's funny how so.
Yeah, I really have heard this song a lot. Can we find something else to play?
You're as cold as ice.
Yeah, okay, that works.
You're willing to sacrifice our love.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.